The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly. Yes, it's time for you to sit back with a cup of tea and get lost in the labyrinth of technology. I'm Alex Kratosky, your pathfinder for the next 30 minutes. And joining me as the guiding lights are digital media guru Jemima Kish and tech head extraordinaire Bobby Johnson. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Is this where we say something funny?
Yes, please. Perform, monkey, perform.
No, I can't. My head's too full of the Olympics.
Oh, you, lots of Olympians.
Glued to it all weekend.
On television?
Go Jamaica.
On television or on the internet?
On Red Button on telly and on proper telly and on the Tinterweb as well.
Okay.
And that sponsorship message from the BBC was brought
We didn't
to you.
Mention the BBC until just now.
Oh,
thank
the
you
red
very much.
Button. It's only on one bloody channel.
I don't know. I don't have digital, which is why I haven't been able to watch the Olympics. But we talked about that last week, so let's move on. On this week's show, we're delving into the twisty passages of Google in search of a light at the end of the tunnel. Leading us through the maze will be observer journalist David Smith. And David, you also write for The Guardian as well. But your experience in explaining the complex algorithms of the search engine scene is unsurpassed.
Well, that's very kind of you to say.
Good.
Do my best, too.
Yes, you better. Now the pressure's on. We're also speaking with the brains behind PitchBase.com, another service that aims to separate the wheat from the chaff, this time in the mucky, murky world of PR and journalism. So grab your press passes and get ready to wave them, please, at James Cox from PitchBase. We will have these, plus the latest news and more from the team. So don't go away, or we'll set a team of digital snooper dogs to find you. Over the past decade, Google, the search engine started by two doctoral students at Stanford University in Northern California, has taken over the world. Literally, they've set up subsidiaries around the globe on a planet that they've mapped. They're a phenomenon. An estimated several gazillion, I believe it is, Google searches are performed per second. Politicians want to be photographed with the founders, and their unique work ethic has arguably changed the way the Western world conducts its business. David, you wrote an article on the search giant for last Sunday's Observer, so perhaps you can tell us why politicians want to be photographed with Larry and Sergey.
Google is the height of fashion. It's the company that everyone wants to be associated with to look sort of cool and cutting edge. And I mean, one person I spoke to said, you know, the internet is the modern religion for politicians. Just look how Facebook has helped Barack Obama's presidential campaign. And, you know, Google is the sort of godhead of the religion, I suppose. And there's been an endless procession of US presidential candidates to their headquarters, both Labour and Conservatives in Britain as well, sort of very keen to bask in the Google glory. And no doubt it's seen as a very quick and easy way to sort of connect with young people.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because it really is the 1980s movie, The Geeks Shall Inherit the Earth. What was it? Revenge of the Nerds. Why do you think, though, it is the fastest growing company in history? Because there have been other companies that should have been there ahead of them.
Well, I think they are technical geniuses. They did do something brilliant 10 years ago at Stanford, came up with an algorithm for searching this sort of new weird thing called the internet. And it was better than other search engines. And so as the internet grew, so Google grew. And it was helped by, you know, sort of very clean homepage, presentationally nice. And then also wonderful marketing in terms of being seen as this fashionable company where people sit around on beanbags and ride scooters around the campus. So, you know, it was an ideal sort of combination of events there. And once it reached that critical mass, there was a sort of runaway effect where, you know, its strength begot more strength. And although everyone thinks and talks about search and maybe some of the other services such as Gmail, the real key to Google, which people think less about, is the online advertising market. And they've now got a very strong position in that. And it is the online advertising which has reaped billions and billions of dollars and made the company worth more than $150 billion now. As so often in history, you know, before them there were other people working on search, and before them there were other people working on online advertising, but in both cases they were the ones who mastered it and perfected it, and the ones who'll now be remembered by history as the others fell by the wayside.
It is actually phenomenal, because I when people were talking about how the bubble was bursting, they were pointing at online advertising. You know, people had been buying banner ads for some ridiculous amount of money. Yet how is it that Google has managed to create something that actually works?
they've had a very clever method to click through the money that is generated each time somebody clicks on an advert, and you know, it's adjustable according to demand. And you know, the second masterstroke was the ability to put adverts on other people's websites. Their critics would argue that they're very aggressive in the way that they negotiate, and perhaps you know, they make a disproportionate amount of money from it, but it's one of those cases where one company's built up such a strong market position now that it's you know, hard for others to compete with that.
It's interesting that, you know, we're talking about 10 years of Google, I think next month's the 10th anniversary, isn't it? And we think, okay, there's a decade there. But actually, really, Google's only been in this strong, powerful position for a handful of years, not for an entire decade. It wasn't until about 2003 when they started to get the advertising bit sorted out, which was by going out and buying people who were doing it. You know, they didn't necessarily grow everything organically. And then a year later when they floated on the stock market, and then that suddenly, you know, that turned them into billionaires. It's really interesting now the way we look at it and we think, bloody hell, Google runs everything, doesn't it? And it's this kind of weird sense of perspective we have where it seems like the internet cannot do without Google. And actually, the two have only been kind of conjoined for quite a short time.
I think there's a lot of corporate jealousy about Google as well. I noticed in your piece you described it as the corporate Death Star. And a lot of the complaints there have been, including the Belgian newspaper syndicate, actually, that had a lawsuit against Google News for illegally using parts of its content and things. You just get the sense that there's a lot of jealousy that Google has done so well, when in fact they were just very, very cleverly exploiting a demand and a service that nobody else moved quickly enough to get into.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I've met people from, you know, Ask.com, formerly Ask Jeeves, and you know,
3% market share US.
Quite. And you know, they tried some, you know, fancy adverts around London to try and persuade people there is an alternative to Google, but you could see they're sort of green with envy, you know, kind of why them and not us. And I suppose the classic case is Yahoo, which will be sitting there thinking now, you know, we should have been Google.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because they should have, and arguably they could have, definitely, and perhaps they should have been, because they started, I think, 2 years before Google anyway. So what went wrong there?
Well, they also had a very similar model, didn't they? Because they bought and bought and bought and bought all of the right people.
Google have always made the platform play, though. This is Yahoo, which was 4 years ahead of Google,
just
for references before people start emailing in their droves. But what Yahoo's done is tried to be a media company. What Google's done is be a platform company. So even though it owns something like Blogger or YouTube, what it goes out there and says is, we provide the space for you to do stuff. Whereas Yahoo says, we provide the stuff and you can do something with it. Yahoo's still a pretty successful company, even though we kind of catalogue its ups and downs. I think it's that differential of success. Google seems like quite a small, lean company that has this enormous reach. And obviously it's got bigger and less lean as time's gone on, but it still seems disproportionate, the amount of control and influence that it has compared to the basic... But what it is.
You're right about that. I mean, how do they manage to cultivate this sense of coherence about what they do when they do so many things?
Picking on what Bobby says in terms of, you know, giving you a platform to do things, I mean, it was almost the first glimpse of Web 2.0 in that sense. For a start, the search engine itself is heavily reliant on users. I mean, that's one of the great things that they pulled off. So much of the labour is actually built on the back of people searching and doing their work for free for them, not to denigrate all the sort of brilliant engineers and all the work that goes on behind the scenes. But it's that plus, you know, platforms for Blogger and YouTube more prominently than any of the others.
Well, YouTube is a very interesting point, actually, because Google quite famously didn't make any money for the first 3 years of its life, and that is something that startups constantly refer to as a way of justifying not having any profit for their businesses when they start out. YouTube was bought almost exactly 2 years ago. What's going to happen with the YouTube purchase? That was $1.65 billion. Are they going to be able to start making money on YouTube in a year's time?
Your guess is as good as mine, in a way. I mean, the current trends in the advertising market perhaps mitigate against it. But do they really care that much? I mean, what's $1.65 billion? You know, it's sort of building the traffic. And one person I spoke to for this article I wrote was saying, you know, frankly, Google are the only company that make money out of the internet. that's probably something of a slight exaggeration and caricature. But you know, there is still this issue of, you know, if everybody else, how do you convert traffic into money? And, you know, Google are doing it brilliantly, but again, through advertising rather than through the ownership of YouTube and, you know, having people upload videos to YouTube. I mean, financially, there's still slight sort of so what about that. Google won't mind too much as long as, you know, the money keeps building. But I think one of their successes as a corporate message has just been the sheer brilliant imagination, sheer scale of it to say, you know, we're going to try and organize all the world's information, make it universally accessible. That's kind of bold and ambitious and fires your imagination. Some people think it's got a dark side as well and worry about the company becoming too powerful, but it's something that one can relate to, whereas the others like Yahoo and a bit messy by comparison.
Well, picking up actually on the user-generated content, I know that we've had quite a few comments on your piece via the tech blog, and I think, Jemima, you've got one that addresses that in particular, doesn't it?
Yes, DVJM, Google is an antitrust case waiting to happen. Any company with their dominance must be a target for antitrust authorities, as it's just a question of time. Just ask Microsoft.
And speaking of that, do you know where the European Parliament investigation is going? Because I know that you mentioned in your piece that they're watching it to see if there's anything that they can do to stop it from taking over the world.
I think their next discussions are in September. And that, I believe, relates to data storage. And it's not just specifically Google. It's a wider consideration of various companies in advertising principally, and how much they should be allowed to retain. And obviously this has become a sort of ongoing issue. But I mean, the EU did approve the purchase of DoubleClick. So thus far, they do not exactly seem to be kind of declaring war on Google or sort of sounding the klaxons.
Jemima, do you have another one?
Yeah, similar note, really. This is Parky DR. I like the services Google provides, but I'm worried about any one company having so little real competition. If Google was owned by Murdoch or Microsoft, there'd be a lot more people worried about it.
I think that's a good point, isn't it? Is Google kind of came out of nowhere, so it didn't have the legacy that some of the other companies like Microsoft or Yahoo even, who are trying to get into those markets. Dustbin Man left a comment. He seemed pretty positive about it, actually, and said, personally, I'm comforted that a 10-year-old company can remain a success without being bought by News International, Microsoft or whoever. To be able to identify Google as a one-trick company in a world where many fingers are in many pies inspires confidence. And the day Google buys Universal or Panasonic is the day my faith in their core product will diminish. So, you know, he's saying they do one thing, they do it bloody well. That's good enough for me.
I think one of the worries is that then they're not just going to do one thing anymore, is it? I mean,
they already do a hell of a lot more than one thing.
Yeah, people think of search, but they're launching many other products and buying many other companies. And it's when they start getting into the mobile phone space.
Well, yes, October, we hear.
People sort of start worrying.
Well, going back to YouTube as well, I mean, my theory, based more on speculation than understanding, is that when they were buying YouTube, what they were actually buying was a huge amount of information on how people watch videos, how people create videos. If the next step is that Google understands how to search that information properly, then they've killed off Blinks and all of the other video search engines that are coming along.
Thank you very much, David, for coming in.
Thank you.
You can read up on Google and many of these other issues and read the original article at guardian.co.uk/technology. But now for more on the land of technology, here's Jemima with the news.
Apple's market value overtook Google late last week, edging to $158.8 billion ahead of Google's $157.2 billion. Analysts credited the iPhone for the growth, which has made Apple the most valuable company in Silicon Valley. Twitter has announced it can no longer afford to support incoming SMS for users outside the US, Canada, and India. A handful of rival services have seized on the new demand, though UK users have focused on demanding that operators offer Twitter a decent wholesale deal on SMS. Yahoo publicly launched Fire Eagle, its location brokering service. Led by former BBCer Tom Coates, Fire Eagle is already being used by more than 50 location services, including travel site Doppler and Brightkite, the social networking tool. East Africa will finally be connected to the world's fibre optic network from October as part of a £322 million project by African investors. The link means an end to connection fees many times higher than other parts of Africa and will open up research, commerce and communications for millions of people.
You can read all about these subjects, plus the latest technology news at guardian.co.uk/technology. Every day, my inbox is rammed with emails from PRs announcing the latest releases, the latest news, and, frankly, the latest molehills they'd like to see made into mountains. Sifting through them is often more difficult than finding what I actually need from a search for Brighton plus sauna. And so when I heard about PitchBase.com, a new matchmaker that aims to put me in touch with the stories I actually want to know about, and here's a hint, games headlines that start with bodacious babes don't tend to work for me. Well, I had to have them in. So I began by asking James Cox, the managing director of the startup, to explain how the current relationship between journalists and PR works.
If you're a brand new PR firm, you go to a database called Karma. It has thousands of journalists, bloggers, email addresses in, and phone numbers and what have you. And you pay somewhere between £5,000 and £10,000 a year to subscribe to this thing. And I have heard up to $100,000 to buy one-off lists for the premium journalists. I mean, it simply is a cash investment to be able to start a PR firm. And then you just start blasting the list with stuff. So by the end of the year, you hopefully have a couple of contacts you've done some work with. And if that doesn't work, you just start sending stuff or, you know, finding other ways to just convince journalists to make them want to write about you. When you get another pamper from Harrods, it's a bit hard not to write a story, I think, at the end, because it's just, you know, there's sort of this obligation.
You're painting quite a bleak picture of PRs, though. I mean, there must be some good ones out there.
Yeah, there are. People who are actually going to the events, they're networking all the time, they're hanging out at TechCrunch, they're hanging out on all these blogs, maybe starting their own blogs. I mean, Brian Solis is a really good example. They're at Futureworks in San Francisco. He started off Bubblicious, one of the best, you know, industry blogs. Why? Because it means he gets to know everyone really quickly. So if he wants to tell Scoble about a new product that's launching or about a new service, he can pick up the phone and Scoble will answer it and actually talk with Brian and there'll be a conversation. Why? There's a context and people want to hear about it. And 9 times out of 10, Brian's probably not selling anything. It's just that he can because he's had the relationship.
So a big side of your idea is really recommendation and filtering. And those are two huge trends on the web.
Yeah, it's about being able to be able to build your own filters, build your own tools, build your own feeds, and get the PR that you want, and then start the conversation. But it's on your terms, so we think it's important to protect your information, your contacts, and so on, and make the whole thing about proving relationship and actually establishing it, and then working it. You know, relationships just don't, you can't just have them and then they stay, and they'll die unless you work on them. So there's all these things we think are a big part of it. So
can you just explain, when we go to PitchBase, what do we see?
Well, you create your feeds for stuff that you're looking for. When you find the bits, pieces that you want, often in your RSS reader or on your iPhone or whatever the way you want to get into it is, you then push through and start conversations.
Yeah, it's a direct way to tap into, straight into it without all of the annoying phone calls and stuff in the middle.
That's right. So as opposed for a publicist to send you pitches, they send the system pitches and then you find them yourself. So if you know that you're writing about something particular that week.
This is all assuming, of course, that we source all of our stories from press releases, which of course
Well, of course
we don't.
You don't. But, you know, if you have a story lead that you're chasing down, you want to tie it into something or find, you know, who's talking about it, who has access to that, then, yeah, press releases are a great way to get through that and then find the right contact.
So obviously, like Jemima suggested, it sounds like PR is broken. So what would you suggest changes?
Well, yeah, I think it's broken. I think it takes a lot of effort to establish a really good list of people that you can talk to all the time. But then, unless you're working it day in, day out, it becomes difficult. And even then, if you are working it all the time, unless you've got something, a particular pretext to talk about, picking up the phone just to say hi, no one really has time for that. Now, what we're trying to do is come up with a different way of looking at that. So we think half the problem is that PRs just generally aren't making good releases. So there's a sort of the concept of the social media release.
What's the social
media? The SMR, the social media release, is this kind of idea of saying, rather than having just one bit of text that is the release for a new story, it's about bringing in different kind of assets to the story. So it's about bringing in video, screencasts, audio.
So more assets, basically.
Yeah, a lot more assets, a lot more access.
Okay.
So that you can begin to build your own individual sort of take on a story. And if you have hundreds of blogs who want to write about something, you know, the new tech space, there are lots and lots of people who are going to pick up a good story. You need to have a sort of a depth, a breadth of sort of things to talk about. It's hard to convince an established news organization like The Guardian or The New York Times to talk about another Facebook story unless maybe it has some quotes from Zuckerberg.
Yeah, it's also a heck of a lot more work, though, from the PR side than it has traditionally been. So how are you going to get the PRs to buy into this?
They already buy into it. I don't have to do a lot of work, but they already know that the great thing about PR is that these guys are in touch with things, and they tend to know that their system is broken. They just don't really have a lot of options right now.
Do we really need PR still, though? I mean, in these days when it's so easy to communicate with people, you're likely to write about people and to bump into people in the community among people that you know.
You could argue that Google is the new PR by finding the kind of resources that you want. But even so, if you Google for a product now, which is the biggest part of PR, product releases, you get pages and pages of where to get the best price, but it's really hard to find decent reviews. And it's because to get those reviews, you need to have that contact between the supplier, the producer, and the journalist to be able to get access to the early releases, to be able to try it out. So PR is still a really important business to be in. It's changed from just being able to tell a story and push it out there to being able to sort of communicate and have a conversation. And the better PR is the ones who are buying into Clue Train, who are buying into these kinds of markets, conversations, ideas. And I'll be able to take that forward. So yeah, we need it, but it needs to change.
If we compare it to other things that have, looked at this idea in the past, you either have subscription from the journalists, and this, the ability to skip through is useful for them, so they'll pay, or you have subscription from the PR companies who say, we will pay a fee to use this service. So where do you fit?
We think there's a bit of both, particularly that it's a service for journalists and it's a service for PR. So we think that both will pay. How much exactly, we're still figuring out, but it's going to be favorable to journalists and, market rates for publicists.
So what you're talking about is a really neat content aggregation system. And Jemima, you mentioned whether we need PRs at all anymore, because arguably the internet is a leveler and we want to be critical and engaged consumers of information on the web. So can you envisage this content aggregator being available for public consumption for people who aren't journalists? Or do you see it only as being for journalists?
No, we think anyone can sign up to it, anyone who's interested in connecting in that way. But I mean, it's a transaction, there's going to be value for both sides of the end of it. So it's not necessarily just about finding the information. We still think that journalists do a great job of telling the story and getting that out there. But one half of that, the first half of it is getting the filtering down and getting the access to this kind of information. But the other half is being able to say, yeah, there's a story here, and let's find a way just to find the right angle to get the information that you want to dig into it. And that's the PR conversation. That's the bit where you sit down and have a chat with someone from PR and make the story happen. So
the technology doesn't do everything then. It's still...
We can't replicate humans yet. No, we're a bit behind. But, soon. Version 2.0.
That was James Cox from PitchBase.com. Bobby's been having trouble with the new Facebook and can't figure out how to update our thriving Facebook group, I Love the Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast. So please do write in and let us know how. Technology is awfully hard, isn't it? Anyway, find us on Facebook, or you can get in touch at tech@guardian.co.uk. That's it for this week. Many thanks to our guests, James Cox and David Smith. Next week, we're back with Jack Schofield in the pod, along with John Honeyball, an author for PC Pro. They'll be talking about Windows 7. Also, we'll have the welcome return of our elevator pitch. So thanks very much to our guests, and a bottle of bubbly to our superior pod team, Jemima, Bobby, and producer Scott in the glass box. Until then, I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.